He's assigned me a rather difficult topic, really. It's not a simple topic. How can I know that there is a God? And of course, we could be very simplistic and say because the Bible tells us so. And that's really not a bad answer, but many people today don't believe in the Bible. They don't believe it's inspired by God. And so that's not a good enough answer for many people. But I'll give you some things tonight that I've prepared, reasons why I believe and I know that there is a God. The first one, you might think is a little bit strange, but let me explain it. Number one is, I can know that there is a God because there must be more than matter. Now, when I was in school, one of the old teachers that I had that was a great teacher was a brother named J.D. Thomas. J.D. Thomas taught a course in philosophy that was one of the best ones I ever took. And he taught me the first lesson I ever had in the study of existence. What exists? And he taught me that there were two extremes on that in the philosophical world. One group, they're actually called realists, and you may think you're a realist, but you're really not philosophically. Realists believe that only matter is real. Really, only matter is real. You may not know this, but the scientific method is based on that. That only matter is real. Nothing else but matter is real. And the only way you can prove anything exists is by if you can see it with your eyeballs or hear it with your ears, or if you can touch it or taste it or smell it. And if you can't do those things, then it does not exist. Where does that leave God, folks? Well, see, they have a method that fits their philosophy, and their philosophy is that only matter exists. Now, the other extreme in philosophy is that only mind exists. When we think of mind, we're thinking of thought, we're thinking of volition, we're thinking of will, something that can purpose and plan and act intentionally, see? Now, I had pictures for you, but I sent them out in cyberspace somewhere, and who knows where they are. But picture a box of salt. If you got a box of salt in your house, that's a thing, and it's got things in it, and it's matter. That's all it is matter. If nobody bothers that box of salt, what's it going to do? It's going to do absolutely nothing. It's just going to sit there, because that's all it can do. It's not animated. You've heard the word animated. The Latin anima means the soul, see? If you have a tube of paint, and that tube of paint is sitting there, what's it going to do? Nothing. It's just going to sit there unless some mind decides to do something with it. You know, you could list any number of things. A car. A car is material. It's matter. That's all it is. And if no volitional mind decides to do something with it, then that car's just going to sit there. Matter, that these pews, you know, the beams up here, all the stuff that we see, it's just inanimate. It's not going to do anything. Matter by itself cannot do anything, see? So it must be that more than matter exists, because there's all kinds of activity around us, and much of that activity is purposeful. Now, I read Darwin a few years ago. I didn't want to, but the origin of the species by means of natural selection. I forced myself to sit down and read that thing. And if you want to be bored out of your ever-loving mind, you can read that book. But Darwin was a geneticist, and he used birds and everything, and he bred them together, and he tried to show that you could change species and so forth. But Darwin had a mind, and Darwin was acting very purposefully, on purpose, doing certain things that he purposed and planned to do with those birds. And when he began to extrapolate his theory of naturalistic evolution, meaning without any help from the outside, if you read his book, he began to talk about Mother Nature. Wait a minute now. And he began to say, she did this, and she did that, and she does this other thing. And he acted as if there was a mind, a person, that was doing all this stuff, when he denied the existence of that person, you see. So you go to something that says our fantasy world, Star Wars, which is based on basically an atheistic philosophy. But even in Star Wars, you've got the Force. Now, where did the Force come from? See, there's a force behind everything. And there can't just be things, because things by themselves don't do anything. There's a force, and we'll talk a little bit later. There's not only a force, but there's a good part of the force, and there's a bad part of the force. And that's another argument for the existence of God. In the Native American culture, they speak of a great spirit. Why do they do that? Because they know there must be a mind behind all of the things in nature. Hebrews 12 verse 9 calls God the Father of spirits. John 4 verse 24 says God is a spirit. And the Bible says in Luke 24 verse 39 that a spirit does not have flesh and bones. So God is not material. He does not have flesh and bones. He is pure mind. He is pure spirit. In the beginning, God, pure mind, pure spirit, created. See, the mind created. He purposefully acted the stuff, the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth didn't do anything, but the supreme mind, the supreme spirit, acted purposefully and created the heavens and the earth. And God said, let there be light. And God saw that it was good. And God called the night day, and light day, and the darkness he called night. God divided the waters above the firmament from the waters under the firmament, etc. God acted purposefully from the very beginning of creation, and he saw everything that he had made, and it was very good. There was not only a spirit, there was not only a mind, but there was volition. Volition means will. The choosing part of us that is like God, see? We choose to do what we do and not do, and God did too. And the only thing that can choose is a mind, see? A body doesn't choose. A mind chooses. Ephesians 1:11, having foreordained us according to the purpose of the one who works all things after his will. So because there must be more than matter, because things don't do anything and never have done anything without a mind deciding to do something with them, there has to be a God. There has to be a God. Or this world couldn't exist and nothing could move and nothing could happen. Now, if that doesn't help you any, let's try this one. I can know there is a God because his creation says so. Oh, I had this beautiful picture floating out in cyberspace of a helix, a DNA helix, you know. And if you ever get into studying DNA and the complexity of DNA and how it's so perfectly engineered, you have to see that there's no way that's an accident. That is so engineered down to the color of the eyes and the color of the hair and the disposition of the personality. And that double helix is a marvel. It's unbelievable. In my beautiful PowerPoint out in cyberspace, I had the picture of a great horned owl. When I was a boy, one of those almost took my head off, and I had his claws in my room. But a great horned owl is a wonder of engineering. How long did it take engineers to develop night vision for our combat troops? That great horned owl has perfect night vision. Also, have you ever seen the thing turn its head around? That head can turn all the way around backwards and look. Can you do that with your head? He can turn it all the 180 degrees back that way, and he can see everything. And he is a killing machine. Those three talon claws on his hand, as he swoops down with those great wings and he grabs a rabbit or a mouse or something like that, those things are razor sharp, and they pinch and they can tear and they can do all those things. Try building a robot that can do what a great horned owl can do. And you'd have to have a team of engineers that were the best, and they couldn't come close to building a great horned owl. See? God's creation is amazing. In Romans 1 verse 20, God says, for the invisible things of God since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even his everlasting power and divinity, so that people might be without excuse. Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth his handiwork day unto day. They pour forth speech night unto night. They bring forth knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. In other words, just look at the beauty and organization of the heavens and the stars and the planets. They scream out in every single language, no matter what place you're standing on as you look up. The Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the people in Alaska, the people in South America, the people in Antarctica, they all look, and in their language the heavens say, there is a God, and he's great and he's powerful and he's divine. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the sea and all that is in them. In Psalm 8 and verse 3, the psalmist said, when I consider thy heavens, the works of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? In Acts 17, verse 24, Paul was trying to explain to the people at Athens about the God who made the world. And he was trying to tell them about this art, this altar to an unknown God, you know, that which you worship in ignorance, I declare unto you. He said, the God that made the world and everything in it, he being Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Neither is he served by men's hands as though he needed anything, because he gives to everything life and breath and all things. And he made out of one man every nation of earth to dwell upon the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the boundaries of their habitations, so that they might seek God, if haply they might feel after him and find him, because he's not far from any one of us, because in him we live and move and have our very being. Even as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. The salmon swims upstream to find the place where he was born, and the swallows return to Capistrano. And it is innate in the soul of man to find his or her creator. I believe there is a God. I know that there is a God, because the creation of God, the beautiful, wonderful, amazing world of God, screams out that there is a creation. We have a song in our songbook. I think you've probably got it. The spacious firmament on high, you know. And in the last of that, it's talking about the heavens and all the wonderful things in the solar system. It says, in reason's ear, they all rejoice and utter forth a glorious voice, forever singing as they shine, the hand that made us is divine. I believe that I can know that there is a God, because you just have to look at creation. If in the morning I'm standing at our window and a male cardinal lights right behind our window, and I just stare at that bird for a second, I'm just shocked and awed of how beautiful that thing is and how amazing every part of it is. When I look at that bird's wing and I look at my arm and I look at the forearm of a squirrel and I look at the wing of a bat and I look at all these different creatures that have the same kind of structure, I see one great engineer with a capital E behind all those things that knew how to design a forearm or a wing. And use the same design over and over and over and over again in jillions of different creatures. So, I can know that there is a God because creation tells me so. Next, I can know that there is a God because I know that there is good and there is evil. Now, many people will argue with this. They will say that there's really no such thing as good and evil. In Isaiah 5 verse 20, long, long time ago, the prophet Isaiah, God said through him, woe to them who call evil good and call good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness. But that's what people do today, isn't it? They call evil good and good evil, and they make laws in our country that call evil good And we have a society that decides what it's going to accept as evil and what it's going to accept as good. But I believe, and I see, that deep within man, and I believe deep within every human being, is a sense of oughtness, a sense of shouldness. I know I ought to. I know I should. There's something inside of us that knows when something is evil and knows when something is good. And my only explanation for that is that God put it there. God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. In Romans 2, verse 14, Paul was talking about the world of the Gentiles who did not have the law of God. And he said, when the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature the things of the law, these, though they do not have a law, show forth the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness to them, their thoughts one with another, either accusing them or excusing them on the day that God shall judge the secrets of men according to my gospel through Jesus Christ. Well, that was a mouthful, but what it says is people have in their soul a sense of oughtness. Now, follow me here. Do you believe in the soul of man? If you do not believe in God, you cannot believe in the soul or the spirit of man either. Do you believe that the soul is responsible, accountable? God said in Ezekiel 18, verse 4, behold, all souls belong to me. As the soul of the Father, so the soul of the Son. Then he said in Ezekiel 18, verse 20, the soul that sins, it shall die. The Son shall not bear the iniquity of the Father, neither shall the Father bear the iniquity of the Son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon him. The soul that sins, it shall die. Now, if there is a soul, that's pure mind. The center of the soul is the will. If you drew a little circle like a cell, and you drew a nucleus in that circle, you can color that nucleus as the will, the deciding, choosing part of man. Flying around the outside of that circle is the intellect. The intellect is giving information to the will, but it's the will that's making the decision. Flying around the circle of that will is also the emotions. The emotions are giving input to the will, but it's the will that decides. And it is the will that is you, that is your soul, and it is the will that is responsible to God and accountable to God. Otherwise, God is unjust, because if we can't choose, we're not responsible. But if we are each a free, moral, independent agent, and we make decisions, and we are judged by our decisions, we are accountable to the capital W-I-L-L, to the great Spirit of God, see, who made us. And he said, behold, all souls belong to me. That's where we got this notion of good and evil. Did you know that the Eastern cultures, like the Chinese and the Japanese and many of the people in the Far East, do not believe in good and evil as we do? They talk about yin and yang. You seen the little twisty black and white circle, you know, that's yin and yang? One part is black, the other part is white. We might think that represents good and evil. No, it doesn't. One part, the dark part, represents the aggressive, baser side of man, but they don't think it's bad. And the other part, the white part, represents the kinder, gentler side of man. They say that it's okay to have both parts, and it's okay if you have to kill somebody to kill them, or if you want to commit adultery to commit adultery. You just have to keep in balance the two parts so it doesn't hurt the community. They do not believe in good and evil. And yet, they still have that in them, because they had to explain somehow the two parts of man. It screams out, there's good and there's evil. I heard an argument the other day on the radio, in a good way, where a young man who was, I guess, a university student or something, didn't believe in good and didn't believe in evil. And they talked with him for a little bit, and he said, well, do you believe the Holocaust? You know, the murder of 6 million Jews, do you believe that was evil? Well, of course it's evil. But they said, well, how do you know it's evil? And he said, well, you just know it's evil because it's evil, you know. And you believe murder is evil? Well, yes, murder's evil. How do you know it's evil? Well, everybody knows it's evil. Well, how do they know it's evil? Didn't God say, you shall not kill? See, God is the thing that decides what's good and evil. Why do you call me good? Mark 10:18, said Jesus. No one is good except God. How do you define good? God. God is good. How do you define evil? Evil is anything that goes against the nature of God. In the Old Testament, there's this word, an abomination. You remember reading that in the Old Testament? Such and such is an abomination. That's the Hebrew word sheketz, which means a detestable thing. Who's it detestable to? It's detestable to God. And because it's detestable to God, who made man and knows what's good for us, that's why it's evil. It's not evil because God wants to give man a hard time. It's evil because it's bad, and it's bad for you, and it's detestable to God. See, and God is the one that determines good and evil. In 1 John 1 verse 5, the Bible says, this is the message we heard from the beginning, that God is light, and in Him there is no darkness at all. There's not a balance of light and darkness. There is no darkness at all. Psalm 119, verse 172. Let my tongue sing aloud of your word, for all of your commandments are righteousness. How do we know what is good? The commandments of God line out what is good. And that which contradicts those commandments is evil. Romans 7:12, Paul said, God's law is holy, and His commandment is holy and righteous and good, because it comes from God. Now man, on man's own, will not do good. Did you know that? The way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his own steps. Man, left to his own base nature, will gravitate to evil. He will follow his own lusts. Romans 7:18, Paul was talking about this, and he says, I observe a different law in me, that is, in my flesh dwells no good thing. Paul knew that if you let the flesh do what it wants to do, you're going to gravitate toward evil. The only way to do good is to turn against the baser nature of man and do the will of God. Do you believe that love is good? I'm talking about biblical agape love. Is that good? Well, of course it is. I don't know anyone who would say that agape love, when you see it in action, is evil. Is hatred evil? Well, of course it is. Everybody knows it is. Is kindness good? Well, it's one of the fruits of the Spirit, isn't it? But is harshness and hatefulness, is that bad? Well, everybody knows it is. They can try to deny it, but everybody knows it is. Is truth good? Truth and honesty, is that good? Well, of course it is. Is unselfishness good? Of course it is. How about selfishness? If you just let selfishness go to seed, would anybody think that that was good? That's evil, isn't it? Of course it is. What about faithfulness and trustworthiness? Somebody that always tells you the truth and you can depend on them, is that good? Well, of course it is. What about someone that's always dishonest and you can never depend on them? Is that evil? Well, you know it is. What about self-control? Is that good? The ability to discipline one's life, is that good? Well, on the other hand, what about unrestrained sensuality? If people just do whatever comes natural, is that good? Of course it's not. That's evil. That leads to chaos. Everybody knows that that's evil. Is mercy good? Of course it is. How about cruelty? Just downright cruelty. Do you not see that that's evil? Why are those things good? Because they are from God. And why are those things evil? Because they go against the nature of our God. Without natural affection, no love in families, is that good? The family falling apart? Of course it's not. Loving families are what's good. And we know these things from God. So where did man get the very concept of good and evil? The very concept of good and evil and the very existence of a sense of oughtness in man proves that there's a God. Because otherwise, there would be no consensus at all in what is good and what is evil. And then, I'd like to share one more thing with you. I can know that there is a God because the Bible is amazing. Now, for many people who believe in the Bible, all we'd have to say is, in the beginning, God, and you'd believe that there's a God. See? But the Bible itself is an evidence that there's a God. Isaiah 40, verse 22. You know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Remember that guy from school? And they decided that the earth was round. But in Isaiah 40, verse 22, 700 years before Jesus Christ, the book of Isaiah says, "He that sitteth above the circle of the earth," talking about God. How did they know in 700 years before Christ that the world was round, when it took a lot of people another 2,100 years to figure that out? How about Leviticus 17:11? Remember in George Washington's day and all the people before, when somebody was sick, they'd stick a little thing in here and they'd bleed them. And they'd bleed them some more if they were still sick, and bleed them some more. And actually they were killing the people. But Leviticus 17:11, 1,400 years before Christ, "The life of the flesh is in the blood. I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. It is the blood that makes atonement by reason of the life thereof." God knew that the life was in the blood. In Leviticus 17, verse 11. Psalm 8, one of my favorite psalms, you know. "What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor, and you put all things under his feet. All sheep and cattle, all birds of the heaven, all beasts of the field, all the fish of the sea." Listen. "And whatsoever passes through the paths in the sea." Well, William Fontaine Maury looked at that verse. He was an oceanographer and a naval officer in the time of the Civil War, right before the Civil War in the 1850s. And he looked at that verse, and he looked at the migrations of the whales that he saw in the oceans, and he says, "I believe that there are paths in the sea." And he began to map the currents, the great sea currents of the sea, and show where the whales were going, and he showed scientifically, sure enough, that there really are paths, there are roads in the sea. He did that in the 1850s or 1860s. That's 1860 years after Christ. David wrote Psalm 8 1,000 years before Christ. And he said, "Man is over and in charge of all the seas and everything that passes through the paths in the sea." How did the Bible know that? You know, there are 40 authors or so in the Bible. And they're all together in prophecy. How did they do all those prophecies way before Christ about his virgin birth, about the place of his birth in Bethlehem Ephrathah? Did you know there were two Bethlehems? And that one Bethlehem, Bethlehem Ephrathah, turned out to be the place where Jesus was born. And Micah prophesied it hundreds and hundreds of years before Christ. How did God prophesy all those things if the Bible isn't true? It predicted everything. It doctrinally holds together. It tells a consistent story. The Bible is God's Word, and it's an amazing, amazing book. When you read the Bible in the original language, some of it blows your mind. Psalm 119 in Hebrew is an acrostic. That psalm is the longest psalm in the book, you know. Psalm 119. It's the one that says, you know, thy word is a lamp unto my feet, and thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee, and all that other good stuff. But that thing goes on, and there's those little divisions that say Aleph and Beth and Gimel and Daleth, you know, like that. Every line in the first section begins with the same letter in Hebrew, Aleph. Every line in the next section begins with the same letter, Beth. And if you see that in the original language, it just blows your mind, because it's amazing that that thing is put together the way it is. The Bible is amazing. And when you think about the truths of the Bible and how that people that really live those truths have the happiest lives and the best families, if they can really incorporate all that into their life, they experience kindness, they experience forgiveness, they experience encouragement, they hold on to all the things that are good and make man good and make life good, and that came from God. That's why we believe in God, because the Bible is an amazing, amazing book. So let's review here real quickly. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them and tell them what you told them, okay? So, why do I know that there's a God? Because, number one, there's got to be more than matter. Matter just lays there like a lump. There's got to be something moving it all, something making stuff happen. There's got to be a God. There's got to be a God because the creation screams. Look at me. Look at the owl. Look at the double helix. Look at the cardinal. Look at the horse and the way that thing's built. Look at your digestive system and your circulatory system and all the other neurological systems and everything. It's amazing. There's got to be a God. How can I know that there's a God? Because there is good and there is evil, and there's no denying that. And the only place good and evil can come from, good comes from God, see? And that's why we know innately what is good and evil. And I can know that there's a God because the Bible is an absolutely incredibly amazing book. And it never ceases to amaze me, even after all these years. Kids, you should never be ashamed of being a Christian. You should never apologize for believing in God. There's more evidence to support faith in God by far than there is to support the idea that there is no God. And as we said before, if all souls belong to God, then we are accountable to God. Romans 14:12 simply says, "So then each one of us shall give an account of himself to God." 2 Corinthians 5 verse 10, "We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive the deeds he hath done in the body according to what he hath done, whether it be good or whether it be evil." Revelation 20 verse 11, "I saw a great white throne, and he that sat upon it, from whose face earth and heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne. And the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of the things in the books according to their works. And if anyone was not found written in the book of life, he was cast into the lake of fire." And then, of course, those in the book of life, if you keep going into chapter 21, they get to go into that beautiful city, the New Jerusalem. You can't go to heaven without Jesus Christ. There may be some people here that haven't been baptized into Christ. It'd be wonderful if you would do that tonight. There may be someone here that just needs the prayers of your brothers and sisters. I know the brethren here would be very glad to pray with you tonight. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand together.